Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
With us right now in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio, we got Kriti Gupta, anchor and markets correspondent for Bloomberg. Also joining us, we got Reed Pickert. She's a U.S. economy reporter for Bloomberg News. She's joining us via Zoom from Washington, D.C. So if you are watching us right now on YouTube or on Bloomberg.com, you can see all of us this afternoon. Kriti, I want to start with you because kind of a puzzling trade going on. At first, stocks were higher, and now they have moved lower.
You know, it's interesting. I feel like the narrative perhaps shifted midday, and you would have thought it would have shifted at about 8:30 a.m. this morning with the jobs report, of course, coming in hotter, 261,000 relative to, I believe, a 193,000.
By the way, the S&P is exactly flat. Sorry, I just wanted to say
that. I know. It was like, yeah. why even bother
There's
showing up to work?
There's some poetic justice there, right?
But this is what
sorry,
I mean.
You were
there
saying, Kriti,
there
sorry.
Was a narrative shift. If okay. you just let me speak,
okay,
Tim,
I'm sorry.
Jesus. we started off with this idea of what kind of pricing in a higher terminal rate. Remember, we have had that narrative going in post-Powell on Wednesday as well, Thursday as well. But if you actually look at some of the pricing here, nothing has really changed that much. We were talking about a 5% terminal rate. The highest that you saw on Fed swaps pricing was 5.1 or 5.25%. That's not a massive change enough to change the dynamic that's in the stock market. And one of the bull cases for the stock market is that the terminal rate is going to stall out, and that is as high as the Fed is going to go. Once that's priced in, there's no reason for the stock market to continue selling off because, once again, it's been priced in. Then you have this dollar move, which I think is the real catalyst of the turnaround that you saw, I want to say, at around 11 a.m., where you had the S&P 500 make a complete flip, because the Bloomberg Dollar Index, if you look, is actually having its weakest day going all the way back to March of 2020. And it's something that's been powering the commodities market from the beginning of the trading session overnight. What it wasn't doing is necessarily showing up in the dollar. Now you're seeing the S&P 500, it feels like, getting more of its cue from the Fed swaps pricing, whereas the dollar is still moving the commodity market. That's a lot of information to say. The market doesn't quite have one single narrative. There's so many factors at play right now. But I would say the biggest move to be conscious of is this dollar move.
Okay, let's rewind, though. We're looking at the S&P 500. That's exactly flat. But let's go back to 8:30 a.m. this morning, Reed. When I look at the Bloomberg News story describing the numbers we got for October payrolls, the lead sentence is that tiny cracks are beginning to emerge in the U.S. labor market's resilience. Reed, I thought this was a super hot print.
It is, but when we think about the jobs report, you have to remember that there's two surveys beneath it. And today was a good reminder that sometimes those surveys don't point in the same direction. So on one side, you had the survey of businesses, which is what informs that payrolls print. And you saw that really strong, you know, 260,000 print come in on that side. And that was broad-based. It was stronger than folks were expecting. And then on the flip side, you had the household survey, which is what informs things such as the unemployment rate, the participation rate, and those wage numbers. And from that survey, you saw a bit more weakness in terms of seeing the unemployment rate rise more than folks were expecting, and then seeing wages continue to keep rising. And like a lot of things, the truth is probably somewhere in the middle. But I think when you put the whole thing together, it paints this picture of an economy and a labor market. Well, a labor market that's just proven to be resilient. It's still really strong. And though it's showing some hints of softening, it certainly has a long way to go before the type of, you know, coming into balance that Federal Reserve officials are hoping to see.
If you're Jay Powell, Reed Pickert, and you see a print like this, what are you thinking?
I think they're still thinking that the labor market is too hot. I mean, when you see a wage number come in, so on a year-over-year basis, wages decelerated a little bit, but on a month-over-month basis, that wage print came in strong yet again. And that adds to several other prints that we've gotten in recent weeks where it shows that wage growth, while showing some signs of deceleration in some pockets, is still really strong. And, you know, from the Fed's perspective, that means that you still have, you know, something like that putting upward pressure on inflation.
I love the question to, like, if you were Jerome Powell, what would you do?
Why?
If I were Jerome Powell, I would retire. You know, I'd sing off into the sunset. But Cree, I'm already thinking about next week. There is a lot going on this week. There's somehow arguably as much happening next week. What is the biggest catalyst when you boil it all down?
Well, you're just going to make me say that next economic data point.
Oh, big time. Let's go.
Tim has already shamed me for.
I teed you
up. Well, come on. Look, it's the CPI report. No surprise there. But I think it's more of going to be a question of, do we continue to see the margin of deceleration we need to? The problem with the last couple of CPI reports is that they've actually missed the economist estimates, which were getting lower and lower to begin with. So the bar kept getting lower. And even then, the data was missing the bar. And I think that's something that certainly hurt the markets quite a bit. There's also already some commentary, some Fed speak in here. I'm just looking at some comments made earlier this morning that could perhaps be responsible for the equity turnaround, coming from Boston Fed President Susan Collins, saying that it might just make a lot of sense to shift to smaller rate hikes. I wonder how many of people in that camp kind of eat their words if they see a CPI number that just isn't coming down fast enough.
All right. Well, that's the question. I mean, we're going to get that inflation data, and the Fed has its work cut out
for it. We also have midterms.
Oh, those things?
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to Arizona.
Not for midterms.
Not for midterms. But it would be a good place if I were not going on vacation and
going
for
reporting. You're probably just
going
to go look at some rocks or something.
I am. I'm going to touch some grass. And,
yeah, big time.
Yeah, do some hiking. Big thank you to Reed Pickert, U.S. economy reporter for Bloomberg News, joining us via Zoom from Washington. Also, Kriti Gupta, anchor and markets correspondent for Bloomberg. She's with us in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, we've been talking about it all day. Payrolls increasing by a higher than expected 261,000 last month. That beat almost every estimate in the Bloomberg survey of economists. The figure compares with an upwardly revised 315,000 for September. So it turns out the Fed still has quite a bit of work to do. Let's now turn to Amy Glazer, Senior Vice President at the staffing firm Adecco. It's one of the biggest staffing firms in the entire world. So Amy and the crew at Adecco have a great idea of what's happening, not just here in the U.S., but globally, too. She joins us this afternoon on via Zoom from Florida. So if you are watching us on YouTube or streaming us on Bloomberg.com, you can see the interview there. Amy, good to have you with us this afternoon. This number surprised a lot of people on the upside. Did it surprise you?
Hi, great to be here, Tim. Thanks so much. Frankly, it didn't surprise me. It mirrors what we're seeing on the field and on the ground. Demand is still hot. It's still a candidate-driven market. And there are still almost two jobs for every job seeker.
And so, Amy, it's interesting to hear you say that and to square that with sort of the corporate news that we've gotten this week. When you think about Amazon, for example, news that they're going to pause adding new corporate workers. We heard some similar things from Apple. Twitter is its own special story, but laying off half of its workforce, I believe.
Twitter laying off half.
Exactly. Yeah. So when do we start to see that come into these big headline figures? And when have you seen any indication of that in your work at Adecco?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Right now, although there are a lot of announcements with a lot of big names, we're really not seeing that demand shift, whether it's being picked up by some small and medium-sized companies from some different sectors. We're seeing puts and takes right now in the market. So I think we'll continue to watch. I don't have a crystal ball, but frankly, I don't anticipate a great deal of change throughout the remainder of the year.
That's
seasonal hiring.
This is really remarkable, Amy. because, yeah. And I want to follow up on Katie's great question about Twitter, because I was actually, before the jobs report came out, I had this like really nerdy group of friends, and we text about this type of stuff. And we were talking about the layoffs at Twitter, and he was saying that he feels bad for all the people who've been laid off from Twitter because it's a really tough job market right now. And I pushed back and I said, look, everybody we talk to says that for tech workers specifically, because every company is pretty much a tech company right now, it is not that difficult for people with those engineering backgrounds to go out and find another job. Is that true?
That's absolutely the case right now, Tim. We're seeing the opportunities still exist. And really, it's actually creating a cool opportunity where folks in the driver's seat can really drive their own destiny and decide what their future work looks like, whether it be the company, the flexibility of hours they're looking for. So I still continue to see those candidates, you know, driving what's going to happen in the future.
Let me just say that my group chats don't look like Tim's. We were not discussing the labor market, but that's really cool, Tim.
Thank you.
But
I'm cool.
Amy, a narrative that I hear specifically when we talk about these tech sector layoffs is that, oh, well, these companies way overstaffed over the past 2.5 years during the pandemic. Is that a theory that holds water with you?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I think, you know, it's really more of a right sizing in a market that has been so white hot over the last 2 years.
Interesting. Okay. So here's the thing. And I kind of posed this question to Reed Pickard a little earlier about Jay Powell. This just means the Fed has so much more work to do, because for the months, the Fed chair has been talking about an overheated labor market, and we're still continuing to see that. So I know you're not focused on the Fed, you're focused on employment, but does it show you that the Fed has a long way to go in order to, try to attempt this soft landing to bring inflation under control? Because if people can get jobs so easily at this point, then that could lead to higher wages and that could lead to higher inflation.
Right. You know, it's interesting. We just released our Global Workforce of the Future report. We surveyed U.S. workers, global workers, and we found that wages, although they're increasing, are still a concern to candidates. And in fact, our data showed us that 2/3 of the U.S. workers don't feel like any wage gains have been enough to heat and eat this winter. So as a result, 51% of U.S. workers right now are actually saying they're open to a second job. So I think we'll continue to see some interesting trends and some folks looking to pick up additional work to kind of offset it. So I think we do have a ways to go there.
Looking to pick up additional work, I think that leads nicely into a question about what could we expect to see this holiday season? You know, when a lot of, especially retailers, try to staff up for some temporary roles, do you expect the same sort of seasonal swing there?
Absolutely. And we're in the throes of it right now. In fact, we've got a national roadshow with a lot of job mobiles out on the streets in these communities that are hiring seasonally, really going to where the candidates reside to make it easy for them to apply. We're still seeing considerable demand. One unique aspect we're seeing a little bit is the shift in retail from the e-commerce world to the brick and mortar stores and pop-up shops. So seasonal hiring, although still strong, looks a little bit different this year. It may not be quite as heavy in the warehouse sector as it is in some of those in-person shopping experiences.
I mean, that comes as no surprise, Amy, given what Amazon said about the holiday quarter being its slowest growth that it's ever seen at this point. So, yeah. Hey, Amy, it's always good to check in with you. Really appreciate you taking the time and joining us on Bloomberg Business Week, especially on Jobs Day. Amy Glazer is Senior Vice President at the staffing firm Adecco. It's a worldwide staffing firm, among the biggest in the world. She joined us this afternoon via Zoom from Ponte Vedra Beach, Florida. Check them out at Adecco USA on Twitter. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Tim Stenovic and Katie Greifeld, and we're just getting started.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists,
But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, in the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week, it's the new economy issue of Business Week magazine. It's available now on newsstands on the Bloomberg Terminal and at Bloomberg.com. There's a piece by Tom Orlick. He's chief economist for Bloomberg Economics. It's all about how national security hawks are muscling aside economists when it comes to set policy direction. We got Tom with us on the line right now. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Also joining us is Joel Weber. He is the editor of Bloomberg Business Week. He joins us this afternoon on the Access line. Joel, I want to start with you because, as Tom writes in this piece, there are two different types of policymakers in the world. That's what we have to imagine. Essentially, those who are looking to increase the size of the pie and then those who are looking for their own share of it. How are we now in this world where it's sort of a zero-sum game rather than a rising tide lifting all boats, at the risk of mixing metaphors here?
There's a few things going on there, but I like the pie part.
Thank you.
So what we kind of talked about with Tom here was something that we wanted to be on the other side of China's recent Communist Party Congress and talk about, because ultimately the story is a U.S.-China one here, and those being sort of the global superpowers that are vying for superiority. And obviously that dynamic is changing and has changed dramatically over the past, even within the past decade. And what Tom, I thought, did a really interesting job pointing out here was the new leadership in China looks dramatically different. And whereas the prevailing, you know, for decades, the prevailing kind of priority on both sides was to expand that pie. And that is just no longer the case. So Tom is a great China watcher, had been when I first met him, he was actually in Beijing. And so I was really curious to get his perspective on what the recent moves within China look like. And of course, he did an even bigger step back story connecting all those dots. So Tom, talk to us about what stuck out to you in this leadership change in China.
Thanks, Joel. So if we focus on the China piece of it, for a moment, the focus has been on Xi Jinping securing a third term as the General Secretary of the Communist Party, and so also China's great leader, China's top leader. Lost in the kind of headlines there was something else really important which was going on, which is the retirement of a whole generation of pro-reform economic policy officials. Li Keqiang, the premier, Yi Gang, and Guo Shuqing at the central bank, Liu He, Xi Jinping's top economic advisor, all heading for retirement, and no one really with the same pro-reform credentials to replace them. So within China, you've got this transition where policy is being set by economists focused on development to policy being set by really Communist Party apparatchiks without that pro-market vision. Now, at the same time, and this is where the kind of step-back U.S.-China perspective that Joel was mentioning comes in, we've seen a changing of the guard in the United States. Back in the 1990s, it was the economists at the Treasury who were calling the shots on U.S.-China policy, saying, yeah, let's be friends, let's expand global markets, let's grow the pie together. Now, here in Washington, D.C., there's a strong sense that that was a mistake, that the U.S. was kind of hoodwinked, they were tricked by the Chinese. And so it's no longer the economists who are calling the shots here, it's the national security hawks. And that means within China and on U.S.-China policy, the focus has really shifted away from growing the pie and sharing the pie and towards securing whatever is ours, mm-hmm. right? And that's a very different world.
Well, Tom, if we further that metaphor about pies and now we're fighting over slices, or the U.S. and China are, if we take score right now, who do you think is winning?
So, look, this is a very, very challenging moment for China. They continue to wrestle with COVID zero, some hopeful signs on social media and in the press in the last few days that maybe the exit from COVID zero might come a little bit earlier than expected, but still a huge challenge for China there. And, of course, they've got all of the problems that come from the massive slump in their real estate sector. Once the biggest driver of growth, now a huge drag. So China right now is in a very stressed position, and that makes the U.S. look relatively strong. But I think if we throw the calendar forward a few years, or maybe even just a few months, I think the relative position might look very different. A China that's exited from COVID zero, a China that's found a bit more stability after its property slump, I think that's going to be a China which looks more formidable again, and we're going to be looking at another assessment of the sort of relative balance of power between Beijing and DC.
Tom, so what about the new leadership that's surrounding Xi? What can we expect from them in regards to policy?
So I think there's been a change on a couple of dimensions, right? So the first dimension, which we already discussed, is the kind of the exit of the pro-reform economists from the leadership. I think that's important. We'll have to see what impact that has. The second is the sort of shift away from a leadership based on collective responsibility and different factions having a voice in the standing committee, to a leadership where Xi Jinping is very much the paramount leader, and he's surrounded by, well, if we're unkind, we'd say his cronies. If we're being kind, we'd say his friends, his allies, and his supporters. Now, the hope there is, well, if you've got someone in charge who's surrounded by people they trust and who makes good decisions, you can get a lot of good stuff done. The risk, of course, is that if there's no one there who can say no to the top leader, if there's no one there offering a divergent point of view, then the risk of significant policy missteps increases.
Hey, Tom, before we let you go, we just have about 40 seconds left here. What does all of this mean for U.S. companies that are trying to do business in China? I mean, Starbucks, Nike, Disney, an organization like the NBA, the list goes on.
So I was actually hoping if we were going to conclude by identifying our favorite types of pie,
okay.
And minus cherry.
I'll go with apple.
But for U.S. businesses, I think the challenge remains, right? You've got COVID zero, which just makes it very hard to operate, tough to get executives in and out of the country. You've got mounting hostility between China and the United States, which means the risk of embargoes, the risk of tariffs, other kind of political risks which could upset the kind of corporate dynamic. So hopefully there's better times for China ahead. Hopefully they exit COVID zero. Hopefully they get through their property slump.
Right.
The multinationals operating there.
Tom Moorlich, we unfortunately have to leave it there. Tom Moorlich, Chief Economist for Bloomberg Economics. Joel Weber also joining us, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Let's talk about crypto right now. You know, it's been about an hour and 20 minutes of this show. We haven't talked about crypto once. Let's
I did that. Say crypto IRL, our new episode.
That's
it's,
true.
It's on tonight.
So we got to mention, we didn't get a discussion. We're going to do that now with Mike Belshi. He is Chief Executive Officer of BitGo. He joins us on Zoom from Palo Alto. Mike, it's great to have you with us. For our audience who might not be familiar with BitGo, tell us what you do and also how that's changed over the past few months that we've had in the crypto industry.
Sure. Thanks for having me here. So BitGo is one of the veterans of the crypto space. We build a wallet as a service platform and a custodian. We service 100% institutions and generally delivering towards more trust in the digital asset space.
Well, let's talk about custodians, because I know you saw the recent news, Mike, about BNY Mellon getting in on holding clients' crypto, which was a really big story just in the last few weeks. Talk to us about competition here. Like, why would somebody choose BitGo over, you know, one of the oldest banks in the country like BNY Mellon?
Well, if it were apples to apples, of course, you would take BNY. Like, first, I, and I think everyone in the digital asset and crypto space, is excited that BNY is here. So BNY, along with Fidelity, you know, both participating heavily in crypto on a go-forward basis, is a fantastic validator for everything we've been working on for the last 10 years. So I feel very grateful that they're here. Now, if you want to talk about custodians, you know, custodians in the traditional world are a bit of a commodity. You know, they're viewed as very similar, and State Street and BNY and JP Morgan, as the three largest custodians of the world, are often, you know, fairly interchangeable. We live in the world's most dynamic, most innovative software industry ever. And so there's a lot to be done. And while, you know, the traditional guys are starting to figure out how to handle Bitcoin a little bit and then Ethereum, there's a tremendous amount of work to be done with the hundreds of blockchains and tokens and staking services and liquidity and building market structure on top of it, which is where BitGo continues to have great business, you know, and we're really welcoming BNY to be part of the force.
Well, when we talk about the traditional guys, the institutional players that you would be working with, I mean, have you seen a similar drawdown to activity among that subset that we've seen in the broader crypto market? I mean, has that impacted demand at all?
Well, all markets are down. So there's not a crypto winter this time. We've had crypto winters in the past, but what we have right now is a macro winter where all asset types are struggling in different ways. In terms of institutional demand, you know, investor demand, actually, it hasn't deteriorated at all. There's definitely a lot of speculation around what's happening in the markets, but the folks that have been participating in Bitcoin and digital assets are just as big of believers now as they were, you know, last year. And you know, you saw the Coinbase report today. So sure, they saw a big downturn on their business overall, but retail was much, much more down than the institutional side.
What do you see institutions doing in the crypto space moving forward? If some of the froth has been wiped out of the industry with the downturn that we've seen this year, what's institutions' role?
Well, institutions, for the most part, aren't participating yet in digital assets. I mean, now at the retail level, you know, we've had significant penetration both in the U.S. and globally, where people have started to hold Bitcoin in particular, but other assets as well. As the institutions come in, it's pretty much all greenfield. And they are responding to their clients that want better products, they want better service, they want to tap into better yields, they want the transparency that comes with Bitcoin. And frankly, I believe the world is still convinced that there is a decoupling that will happen from Bitcoin and the rest of the markets. Now, we haven't seen it yet because, you know, the Bitcoin market is very small. But if that decoupling occurs, you know, we're going to see a tremendous boon for, you know, digital assets, and really proving the thesis behind it.
But Mike, what could potentially cause that decoupling?
I think it's just a matter of time. So what causes it is when we get to a level of volume where, you know, we're no longer just kind of a risk asset among many. Why did crypto have such a good year, you know, last year? You know, on the backdrop of COVID and monetary policies across the globe that are questionable at best, it's clear that, you know, look, the stock market is headed for more rocky times. You know, last year, the bond market was at zero to negative if you're in Europe. Now, obviously, the bond market is a little bit different right now because of what's going on with the rapid change of monetary policy to deflect inflation. But, you know, Bitcoin is really the one asset that's there that's like, look, it's a deflationary currency. It's not an inflation currency. And you want to correct against bad monetary policy. You know, having Bitcoin in your portfolio, even if it's only 3 to 5%, can have a dramatic impact on what your returns are going to be just a few years down the road.
Hey, Mike, you guys were acquired a little over, it's been almost 2 years, by Galaxy Digital back in May of 2021. We did find earlier this week that Galaxy Digital is exploring eliminating as much as 20% of its workforce against the backdrop of this digital asset market downturn. What are you seeing inside BitGo, though, when it comes to how you're thinking about the economy in 2023 and changes that you've had to make as CEO?
Sure. Just a slight correction. We weren't acquired by Galaxy. There had been an effort to do that, but we called that off this year.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Apologies for the error.
Yeah. But anyway, just to correct there. So BitGo is completely independent. We're the most regulated and compliant, you know, custodian in the space. The wallet as a platform service, you know, still powers 20% of all Bitcoin transactions, and the business is very healthy. In terms of the layoffs, and you know, not talking about Galaxy specifically, but look, you're seeing layoffs across America, across corporate America, right? So we saw it from Stripe, and you know, there's been literally every day another announcement of who's laying off. So it's not surprising at all to see this inside of crypto as well. And when you've got your asset, your revenues tied to asset prices, and asset prices are declining, it makes it a challenging business environment. Now, BitGo was profitable last year, so we've managed, I think, pretty well. We've been through three of the crypto winters. This one's a macro winter, but we'll continue to manage it. And look, every business has to figure out how to make both the top line and the bottom line come together.
Well, zooming out and looking at an industry-wide level, as Tim mentioned, I mean, there's been layoffs at crypto companies. We've seen a lot of turnover at the C-suite level at crypto companies. Would you expect to see broadly a wave of consolidation coming to the crypto industry next?
I think it's quite likely. So look, especially on the smaller companies that are out there that are trying to get first, product market fit and then some scale, it's a rough time to do so, especially if you've got limited financing. I would expect that early next year we could see some real consolidation. BitGo could be participating in that. There's a number of adjacent businesses around what we do that we could add into the mix.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that. Like what kind of businesses?
Well, so today, if you look at custody in crypto, the custodians are all different. Unlike traditional custodians, where I mentioned earlier that they're a bit commoditized, in the digital asset space, everybody's got a different product offering. So first off, at the base layer of which coins are you supporting, which layer twos are you supporting? Do you have staking capabilities? Do you have cold storage capabilities? Can you trade straight out of cold storage? Things like that. These are all varied across the different custodians. So I think right now, there's an opportunity to consolidate in the space, kind of fill those gaps and really come out of this recessionary period as a very, very strong custodian.
Well, Mike, let's zoom back in and talk about BitGo. Are you thinking about acquiring or looking to be acquired at this point?
Well, not really looking to be acquired right now. And spent a lot of time on that in the past. And I think right now we just want to go build. And so yeah, absolutely, we're looking around and we've had a number of companies that have been close to us. And yes, we will be acquisitive when the opportunities present themselves over the next 6 to 9 months.
Hey, Mike, what kind of cash do you guys have to make acquisitions right now?
We don't publicly state our balance sheet, but like I said, we've been profitable since last year. We might have put a fair amount of our treasury into Bitcoin some number of years ago, and that's put us in good stead for the go forward basis. So we put our money where our mouth is, I guess you could say, and we're in good shape. We're not as big as a Coinbase, but we've got our own benefits.
Well, Coinbase is getting smaller, but Mike, you said that it's time to build. I've heard that a few different times on crypto Twitter specifically. What does that mean in BitGo's context?
Well, like I mentioned earlier, this industry changes super fast. So when we started, it was about what's the technology to secure the asset? And we spent the first 3 years of our existence really solving that problem. We've got multi-sig, we've got MPC capabilities. So we've got a tremendous amount of technology that solves the security problem. Then we grew into compliance and regulatory. We built out trust companies now in four different regions. We've got them here in the US, we've got them in Germany, we've got them in Switzerland with more coming. And then on the go forward basis, the technology continues to evolve. A lot of our clients are now coming from the Fortune 100 corporates, and corporates have not really embraced cryptocurrency per se, but all of a sudden with NFTs and digital property ownership, they're coming and they're saying, hey, can you help us? And it's very much the same conversation that we had in 2016 where there were companies, financial institutions that wanted to participate in cryptocurrencies with private keys. Now we've got corporates coming and saying, hey, can you help us with our digital property, which has got private keys and overlaps with money? So anyway, the time to build, there's DeFi out there, there's Web3 out there. We now have the ability to build amazing smart contracts to take on amazing functionality. It's going to continue to shift and change. And BitGo builds a ton of infrastructure that helps companies that are building.
Mike Belshi, Really appreciate you taking the time and joining us this afternoon on Bloomberg Business Week. Mike is CEO of BitCo, joining us this afternoon via Zoom from Palo Alto, California.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
It is already time for the Drive to the Close. Wow. Katie.
Yeah.
Time flies when you're having
sure
fun.
Sure does, yeah.
Hey, very pleased right now to be joined once again by Alan Zafran. He's founding partner and co-CEO of IEQ Capital. He joins us once again, this time via Zoom from Foster City, California. So if you're watching us on YouTube or at Bloomberg.com/QT, you can see Alan's interview in addition to hearing it. Alan, good to have you back with us. How are you?
Doing great, Tim and Katie. Thanks for having me on again.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us. Hey, I wanted to start with what we heard from the Fed chair on Wednesday. He was asked about the possibility of still pulling off a soft landing. And he answered that he thought it was still possible, though the path has since narrowed over the last few months. Is it possible to avoid a recession at this point?
It is possible, but it's getting harder and harder to avoid that recession. In effect, we've kind of had a rolling recession, which started at the beginnings of this year, rolling through different sectors of the economy. And so what's happening is you still have an incredibly strong labor market, and it's inevitable that these rate hikes are going to take 6 to 12 months to work their way through the economy. It's going to be difficult to see how it's all going to work out. However, to the extent that investors, individuals, and businesses had strong balance sheets and refinanced themselves long before the rate hike started, coupled with the fact to the degree that some of these jobs are going to hold, we might make our way through this, despite all the pessimism that's out there.
I like that optimism.
Yeah, geez.
Nice. Alan, we can just leave it there, okay? Yeah,
maybe
Team
it's
soft
not,
landing.
Not such a pipe dream after all, but I am curious.
Can I make one other comment?
I would love for you to
went
do
back,
that.
If you went back to that Fed meeting, okay, if you read the statement, it was pretty dovish.
Mm-hmm.
If you listen to the press conference, Powell was hawkish. And so you saw a reversal in the market intraday sharply.
I believe, Katie, you called it, what did you call it?
A bait and switch, baby.
I'm going to give you a different answer.
Ooh.
That was the Fed defending its independence and its unwillingness to bend to political pressures.
Interesting.
So if you go back to 2018, President Trump at the time was trying to push the Fed to be more accommodative. And it upset the Fed. And so they pushed back in the press conference were more demanding. This time around, I think perception from the Fed is that they're being encouraged by certain politicians to show some semblance of being accommodative. And they want to ensure their mandate is to keep inflation at a moderate, hopeful, eventually 2% annualized level, as well as keeping full employment. And I feel like they were put in a box and Powell had to get up to defend the credibility. And in fact, I think the Fed has been put in a difficult position and has done quite a good job to maintain the sense it's got independence and credibility. And that alone is enough to calm the markets and prevent a much worse financial outcome. So you get short-term pain, you get the stock market correction, potentially a modest recession, but you avoid the cataclysm of an inflation rate that's out of control, which would cause much greater and much longer term harm. And that's what I think happened on Wednesday.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, at the end of the day, what does a central bank have other than its inflation fighting credibility? We know that the Fed definitely, that's a priority for them. But I'd love to hear your thoughts on when we do eventually get a pivot and the market has made a run at this trade over and over again, keeps getting their heart broken. But when there is a pivot, do you think that's a bigger bullish catalyst for stocks or for bonds?
No, it's a bigger bullish catalyst, I think, for stocks, because I think it's a signal that they're going to ease up conditions and stocks are just a higher beta asset class. But I will also make the argument that it's becoming evident the Fed is signaling, despite the hawkish press conference, we're getting closer to the end game of the tightening. And you're seeing that because the bond market's already inverted. And it's telling you it's time to start thinking about extending durations or buying longer term bonds, because long-term bonds are nothing more than the summation of short-term rates over a long time frame. If you buy a 10-year treasury bond, it's like buying 40 three-month treasury bills. If the three-month treasury bill is tied to a Fed funds rate, if the Fed's eventually going to pivot and lower that rate down, the average over the next 10 years is the Fed funds rate is going to average a lot less than 4.25%. So you have to start thinking the bond market is pretty attractive, and that can happen before the Fed actually does the pivot itself.
Okay, you said the P word pivot a couple times there, Alan. So I got to ask you to, you know, exactly when that's going to happen. You said the Fed's going to pivot eventually. When is that eventually? And also, what is that pivot? Is that just stopping to raise rates, or does that mean that it actually starts to lower rates?
Or pause, just to put in another word.
Okay. Yeah, okay. You have a nuanced pivot and the real pivot. The one that people care about most is probably the first one, where they signal they're more or less done with rate hikes subject to data. And that's probably happening when inflation data is showing three consecutive months of decelerating. What we are fearful of, and if you're bearish, is that the Fed's only going to pivot when the PMIs, the Purchasing Manager Index, which is a broad measure of economic activity, if it were to really plummet, the Fed would have no choice but to do so. And that probably only happens coincidentally with the labor market starting to get out of control. If that were to happen, that's going to probably not happen until the middle of next year, because in this strong labor market, it's going to take time for jobs to meaningfully drive the unemployment rate higher. We're hearing snippets of firings, but we're not nearly at the level yet where the Fed is going to feel that it needs to pivot to equal the mandate on employment with inflation.
I mean, Katie, look at this morning's numbers that we got.
Look at this morning's number. Yeah, not much to argue with. But Alan, before we get to the pivot, maybe we get a mild recession. What do you do in the meantime? What is your highest conviction right now in your portfolio?
Well, let me give it two answers. What you do is you stay well diversified. When uncertainty comes, you have to be more diversified, and you also have to elongate the time frame into which to invest, because although you and I on this call even want to find the pivot and the bottom, we can't time it perfectly. So as an example, if you want to be a buyer of high quality stocks, it's a great time to begin to, I'll use the word nibble, but you slowly dollar cost average over a much longer time frame, because you don't know where that bottom is. It might be next week, but it could be 3, 6, or 12 months from now. Highest conviction ideas are twofold. One is short duration.
Looks like we lost Alan. He froze for just a second, but we do unfortunately have to wrap up there anyway.
I'm so sad because I think he was going to say short duration, and that's like catnip for me.
Yeah, I'm sorry. No. Oh, Alan, are you still there? We just lost you for a second.
So if you can see me, I'm saying short-term bonds are not a bad place in short. However, I also think for those that can do so, buying secondary investments,
right,
for those handfuls of people that can buy other people's illiquid positions who are over-leveraged and need to sell, mm-hmm, I think it's a fantastic opportunity.
Alan Zafran, founding partner and co-CEO at IEQ Capital on Zoom from Foster City, California. Alan, always great to chat with you. Thanks so much for joining us on at Bloomberg Business Week.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.